This recording is from Christ Kingdom Church in Avalon Park, Orlando. Visit us online at christkingdom.org for our calendar, driving directions, and more audio recordings.
Well, good morning. It's good to be with you this Sunday morning, as always. And as we begin, if I'm honest with you, as we start, I have a fear. And the fear that I have is this. In the culture that we live in, it seems like that often who we are gets strangled and suffocated and buried by what we do. And as we come this morning, I fear that who we are will get lost in having something piled on extra that we have to do. To do, to get it right, and if I don't get it right, I just need to try harder. I'll always remember this past fall, last year, sitting with a friend, and as he was talking about his life, I had this weird picture come to my mind. I sometimes have weird pictures come to my mind, and the picture that I had was of a greased-up bodybuilder. Now, let me explain that. He was talking to me about, okay, he's a full-time MDiv student, so he's learning Greek, Hebrew, how to preach, all these things. He's a full-time counseling student, which means he's learning how to counsel people, and he actually is counseling people. He does youth ministry 30 hours a week. He is married. He has a lot of stuff going on with his family that he's being called to engage well with his parents. And the reason that I had this picture come to my mind is, as I looked at him, I said, right now life for you seems like that you are just having to be locked into place. So for example, when you are a bodybuilder, essentially when you compete, what you do is you hold a pose, you get in your pose, and you hold it. And you wait, and you hold your pose. And you have to keep all of your muscles flexed so that the people that are judging can see the definition of your muscles and point out and realize this man has not only built up ridiculously large and disgusting looking muscles, but he can hold them in place for a long point in time. And I said it just seems like, okay, so you have to hold this one arm flexed and to be a good youth pastor, and so you can't let up, and so you always have to keep trying really hard to do it right. And if you don't do it right, people are going to see that you don't have what it takes and that you don't have the muscles to do what you're supposed to be doing. Okay, and this other arm you've got to flex and be a good student. And the same thing could be said for that. You have to hold it together. And then with your legs and with your abs, you have to hold together being a good husband and a good son and a good brother. And I fear that often that the way that we approach our life with God is like that. That we feel like that here are all these things that I have to do right and have to hold together. Otherwise, my life will fall apart. And as we come to a morning where we think about community, I fear that a morning of thinking about community would become one more thing that you have to do right. One more thing that you have to hold together. What if God has something different for us than having to hold it together? What if God has something different in community than having to hold it together? We are a busy, overstimulated people. We are a weary people. I feel that in my heart and soul even this morning, and though we could spend all morning talking about the effects of that, Scott has asked me to continue our sermon series on All In, and has asked me to think about together being all in community. And so that's what I want to do this morning. And my hope is, if my hope is to not pile one more thing on you to have to do, my hope is this. My hope is that we would be exposed to truth and that truth would set us free. So what is the truth going to set us free to do? We will explore that this morning. And what I'm hopeful to do is to invite us to a sense of community as being something that we already have in place and that God is inviting us to move into. For thousands of years, there has been different forms of prayer called the daily offices. Men and women of faith have risen early and returned often throughout the day to these prayers. There is a morning office, a midday office, an afternoon office, an evening office, a night office. And even for those that are like the real Christians, they get up in the middle of the night to pray these offices. And whenever I partake in praying the offices, I feel like that I am being invited to continue on the wilderness journey of men and women, fathers and mothers of the faith that have gone before me, who are inviting me to walk the same road that they did, to one day hearing God say, "Well done, good and faithful servant." And one of my favorite parts of these prayers is the part towards the end where it invites us to pray for those who have been given to us and to whom we have been given. And so maybe even I'll just pause there for a second. Who would those folks be for you? Who are those that have been given to you? Who are those that you have been given? You see, community is something that is a gift to be given and a gift to be received. And it is something that we already have in place, because God has given us to others and given others to us. And so as we seek to wonder, what does it mean to be all in community? What does it mean to live in community with others? I think it's really helpful to think about Old Testament Israel. And we'll look at community through the lens of the Israelites as they were sojourning from Egypt to the Promised Land. And so to do that, I would invite us to turn to Joshua 1. And we will be reading verses 1 through 11. So after the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord said to Joshua, son of Nun, Moses' aide, "Moses, my servant, is dead. Now then, you and all these people get ready to cross the Jordan River into the land I'm about to give to them, to the Israelites. I will give to you every place where you set your foot, as I promised Moses. Your territory will extend from the desert to Lebanon and from the great river, the Euphrates, all the Hittite country, to the great sea on the west. No one will be able to stand up against you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will never leave you nor forsake you. Be strong and courageous, because you will lead people to inherit the land I swore to their forefathers to give them. Be strong and very courageous. Be careful to obey all the law my servant Moses gave you. Do not turn from it to the right or to the left, that you may be successful wherever you go. Do not let this book of the law depart from your mouth. Meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do everything written in it. Then you will be a prosperous and successful people. Have I not commanded you, be strong and courageous? Do not be terrified. Do not be discouraged. For the Lord your God will be with you wherever you go." So Joshua ordered the officers of the people, "Go through the camp and tell the people, 'Get your supplies ready. 3 days from now you will cross the Jordan here to go in and take possession of the land that the Lord your God is giving you for your own.'" This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. One of my professors recently said that the story of the Bible, that creation and fall and redemption and restoration process and consummation, is lived out once and 1,000 times in our life. Haven't we all experienced these different parts of life? Creation, experiencing new life, experiencing fall as we struggle, redemption, restoration process, and consummation. And so as we come and think about community, it seems really fitting to look at part of the story that God has told through the eyes of the Israelites. And so as we come to this passage in Joshua, there are a couple of realities that the Israelites are experiencing that I think pertain to us and are things that even Scott in the last month has shared with us. The first thing I want to point out is that the Israelites were a tabernacle people. In Exodus 25, God says to Moses, "Then have them make a sanctuary for me, and I will dwell among them. Make this tabernacle and all its furnishings exactly like the pattern that I will show you." So God says to the Israelites, "I will dwell with you." Because of Christ and His life and death, and because of His sending the Spirit, we are tabernacle people as well. We are people in whom God dwells. God abides in us as we abide in Him. And being image bearers, because of God in us and being made in the image of God, we reflect God and who He is. And because of that, like Christ, we are to do what we see our Father doing. We're ultimately called to be little Christs. The word Christian, a different way of saying it, is to be little Christs, to be Christ incarnate. So we are a tabernacle people in whom God dwells. But in addition to that, we are a wandering and homeless people. The Israelites at this point in time were 40 years removed from the triumphant exit from Egypt, in which their enemies were smote and left in the dust, and not actually dust, but left drowned in the sea. 40 years later, after walking through the wilderness, the Israelites are homeless. Don't you feel that in your life as well? I don't know about you, but in my heart of hearts, I feel so unsettled. The nature of my life feels like as soon as one part of my life gets settled, another part becomes unsettled. Really simply, that's because we are a homeless, wandering people. We are a people on an exilic journey from our own Egypt to the promised land. This summer I talked about the idea of being in between Eden and eternity. We know in our heart of hearts that we were created for Eden, a place where there is life flowing naturally. And we long for the day in which we will experience life where all things are made new in heaven. We are a homeless people. This place is not our own. In Hebrews 11, the author of Hebrews talks about the people of faith that have gone before us. And at the end of the chapter, he said, "The world was not worthy of them. They wandered in deserts and mountains and in caves and holes in the ground. These were all commended for their faith, yet none of them received what had been promised. God had planned something better for us, so that only together with us would they be made perfect." And then he transitions into chapter 12 saying, "Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every sin and weight which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race set out for us, looking to Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God." As we come this morning, that is what I hope that truth will set us up to do. I hope not to lay one more thing onto us to flex and have to hold it together, because the nature of a flexed life where we have to hold it together is one that is stagnant. If I always had to flex my muscles, I couldn't walk. Or if I did, it would be a limping walk. God invites us to be free and to walk, not out of our own strength, but because we are looking to Christ, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising its shame, and is now seated at the throne of God, where we will one day join in worship of him. And so one reality that we have that the Israelites didn't have is that we live, part of our in-between is we live in between Christ and the consummation. We live in between Christ's life and death, and now have God tabernacling in us. And yet we wait for the day in which all things will be made new. And one of the things that Christ said to his followers was, "I come to give you life. I come to give you life to the full." A lot of times I don't know what to do with that statement. Because this side of Eden, this side of eternity, every bit of life that I experience seems to be coupled with death. Genesis 3, when the fall happens, God's curse to Adam is that it's with pain and with thorns and thistles that you will bear fruit in this life. It's this very picture of death swarming and entangling life. Every bit of death that we experience has life right alongside of it. Every bit of life that we experience has death seeking to strangle it. We see it every day. As the sun dies at the end of the day, we see a new night coming to birth. And as night begins to be put to death, we have new life that comes in. Think about a seed. For a seed to bear fruit, it must die to being a seed and become something new. And if nothing else, when we come to the end of the service and celebrate the Lord's Prayer, that is the picture of death and life being tangled. Christ's death brought with it life. Every bit of death that we experience has life with it. Every bit of life that we experience has death with us. Maybe this is a silly picture. I've been thinking about life and death this week. We're getting ready to experience death and life. When you drive down the road and have your car covered by love bugs, if that's not death, I don't know what is. But being that I have lived in Orlando for 1 year, love bugs coming signifies life in that weather begins to cool off. That, to me, that may be a silly example. That is death and life existing hand in hand. And though that's a silly version, I think that it's a picture. And so as we come to our text this morning of Joshua, we find that very thing being the case. Moses, the man who for 40 years had led the people of Israel through the wilderness, dies. And yet it is 3 days later that Israel will finally enter the promised land, the land flowing with milk and honey. And so what do we do with this? What do we do with this reality that this life is one in which we experience great death, but we also experience great life? We experience the death of dreams and relationships as we experience rejection and disappointment. Yet we also experience new hopes and dreams, and we experience new relationship. So what are we to do with that? What are we to do with the fact that Christ says, "I came to give you life to the full," and we experience life and death? What I would present to us this morning is what Paul says in Romans 12:15, where he says, "Rejoice with those who rejoice, and mourn with those who mourn." As we are on our own exilic journey, we have the opportunity to offer the gift of rejoicing and to receive the gift of rejoicing. We have the opportunity to offer the gift of mourning and to receive the gift of mourning. So what does it mean to rejoice with those who rejoice? Interestingly enough, the word for rejoice that Paul uses here is used in a couple other ways in the New Testament. The Greek word is kairo, and that would be a word that would be used as a form of greeting. In a lot of Paul's letters to the different churches, this is the word that he would use them. And even as I was thinking this week about greetings, I was thinking about last Friday I flew home to Knoxville to celebrate my dad's 60th birthday. And as soon as I got off the plane and turned on my phone, I had a text from my mom saying, "Call me when you land." And so I kind of wondered, did something happen? Is there like a switch of plans that I'm getting ready to have to think through and work through? And so I get off the phone, I'm walking through the terminal, I call her, and she said, "Hey, I just wanted to make sure that you landed safely." My mom is a mom. That's what moms do. And I said, "Yes, Mom, I landed safely. And I even like put on my clothes and tucked in my shirt this morning. Everything's good to go." But the other thing that she said was, "We're just really excited to see you. We're really glad to have you in town." My mom was rejoicing in the fact that I had flown 600 miles and landed, and that evening she would get to see me. That part of rejoicing makes a lot of sense to me. That use of greeting. "We're greeting you. We are so excited to have you here. We're welcoming you in. I can't even wait to see you tonight, so I'm going to text you and have you call me because that's how much I want to be with you." But the other use of this word kairo, one of the other uses would have been in saying farewell. In a lot of Paul's letters, he used this word as well to say goodbye to the people. And which strikes me as, why would that be the case? And I don't think that I would have had thoughts for it until about a year and a half ago when I moved to Orlando. I remember sitting with dear friends, thinking about saying goodbye to them. It was the last time that I would be sitting with them and having time with them for a long time. And the wife looked at me and said, "I hate goodbyes. I hate goodbyes. I feel like that God keeps putting people in my life that I have to say goodbye to, and it breaks my heart." And what it makes me do is long for the day in heaven where there will be no more goodbyes. Where no longer will we say, goodbye, I don't know when I'll see you again. And what I experienced as I drove down to Orlando was the sadness of saying goodbye to people that have known me and loved me well for 20 years of my life, who have walked with me and cared for me well for the 20 years that I lived in Knoxville. And what I experienced and thought and felt from that was thankfulness. Amongst the sadness of leaving was, what a blessing it's been that these people have lived life with me and cared for me and loved me these years. What a blessing that God would give those people to me and me to them. You see, I think the idea of rejoicing is one of paying attention to the gifts that God is giving us and offering thanksgiving to Him. We can say hello and greet one another with joy and be thankful. And yet we can also say goodbye and be thankful for the fact that they've even been in our life to say goodbye to. And so what does that look like? What does that mean for us as folks that are living in this exilic journey, this community life together? Maybe just a couple thoughts. One thing that they would do in the Old Testament, there's a story of Samuel building an Ebenezer. Ebenezer is a stone of help. And we sing that song, Come Thou Fount, a very blessing. And one of the verses, here I raise my Ebenezer, hither by thy help I'm come. And so what that's saying is we create these stones. We create things in our life that are helping us to remember the ways that God has blessed us. What would it be like to be one who in community pays attention to the gifts that God has given and to mark those events, to mark those gifts? Maybe it means having a feast. I've lost, and a lot of y'all know this, in the last year and a half, I've lost over 100 pounds. That has been a really fun thing for me. And when I hit the 100-pound mark, one of my friends had me over, and we bought probably 15 pounds of meat. And we treated it. We put different rubs on that. We made chicken wings. We made steaks. We made bratwurst. We made hamburgers. And we just pigged out, which kind of seems ironic. I just lost 100 pounds, so I'm going to eat it all back right now. But it was a night of him saying, that's worth celebrating. So we're going to intentionally set aside time to celebrate. And in that moment, it was a moment of thank you. Thank you, God, that I've been able to journey and lose 100 pounds. But thank you even more that there are people in my life that want to celebrate that with me. What if we were a people that celebrated places of life together? What if part of living in community with those that have been given to you and to whom you have been given is celebrating places of life? And so we rejoice with those who rejoice. But the other side of that is that we mourn with those who mourn. Really simply said, what if the best thing that you have, what if the greatest gift that you can offer to those around you in your life right now is your mourning and your grief and your lament? Because it's in there that God meets us. God's promise in the Beatitudes is not that He will take away the pain. He says, blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. What if it's a great gift to offer community of mourning, because in that God is seeking to comfort? So what is mourning? I think that we don't, I think that a lot of us, myself included, don't know what that looks like well. I remember when I first started losing weight, I started realizing that there was this thing that I did. At the end of a really hard or long day, as I was driving home, I would drive by the McDonald's at the corner right before I get to my house, and I'd go, man, it has been a long day. I don't feel like going home and cooking. I deserve to get a Big Mac meal with fries and a Coke. I deserve that. It's been a long day. I'm going to treat myself. And so I would mourn by being unhealthy and eating a Big Mac meal. And the really interesting thing on the other side of that is if I'd had a really good day, I would say, it's been a great day. And so I'm going to celebrate by not going home and cooking, but by getting a Big Mac meal on the way home. I think what a picture of numbing the effects of the fall. Numbing the fact that we experience great death and life. I numb myself with food. And I think that we all numb ourselves in one way, shape, or form. And what I would say is the extent to which we seek to numb ourselves to the death that we experience is the extent we probably numb ourselves to life that God has for us. So what is it? What does it mean to grieve, to mourn, to lament, besides getting a Big Mac meal? Here are just a few thoughts that I had a wise man share with me this summer. He said, we invite people to relationship with God and engagement with God. And essentially, that is what lament hinges on. It hinges on the fact that we have a relationship with God, and God invites us to that. Lament is embrace of reality. But in the midst of this embrace reality, the invitation is to take hold of God, to grab Him, and to shake Him. I was talking with a friend a couple weeks ago, and I was just saying, I feel like that lately I'm just this little child throwing a temper tantrum. I'm just so frustrated with the way that my life is going right now that I feel like that I'm just this three-year-old beating on the chest of his father. And what my friend said to me was, you know, one of my very favorite moments with my son is, who is two, is when he will do something like try to get a knife out of the dishwasher and start playing with the knife. I will stop him from getting that knife and playing with that knife because two-year-olds and knives, not a great combination, so I'll stop. And he will be really angry with me that I'm taking away what he wants. And he will begin to wail and to scream and to yell. And some of that frustration is the fact that he can't communicate and say, Father, I want this knife. I will be careful with this knife. Just let me play with this knife. Now, son, you're only two. Two-year-olds can't engage in that conversation, so some of the frustration is the fact that he can't communicate. And so as his son wails and bemoans the fact that he's lost what he wanted, he said, you know, I will pick up my son and talk to him and explain, son, I know that you don't believe this and may not even be able to understand this, but that will do you harm. You can't have that. And I will bring him close to myself. And he will initially be still screaming and he'll be punching me in the neck, which after a while, even though it's a two-year-old, begins to hurt. But as I hold him and continue to speak tenderly to him, slowly what began as crying and screaming and punching becomes him becoming limp and loose in my arms. Because he's transitioned from screaming and yelling to trusting. Trusting that my heart for him is good. What if we miss out on the opportunity to go limp in the arms of our Father who rejoices over us with singing because we don't engage with throwing a temper tantrum? And I think that it would be important to say that there is an end to our lament. There should be a transition and movement out of grief. The sadness is still there, but there is a movement in a different direction. Grief moves. It's not stagnant. And just have a couple quotes on lament that I think that have been really helpful for me. One is Eugene Peterson, who says this. He says, Lamentations pays detailed attention to the exact ways in which suffering takes place. It takes with absolute seriousness the feelings that follow in the wake of judgment. And then it shapes these feelings and sufferings into forms of response to God. Lamentation calls us to pay attention to everything men and women feel, especially when that feeling is as full of pain and puzzlement as suffering. And then one other quote that I think helps address this idea of what is the balance between just whining and complaining and sitting in a temper tantrum and grieving and lamenting. A guy named Chuck DeGroat says that lament is ultimately hopeful. That seems paradoxical, doesn't it? The person sitting before you is weeping and wailing about his pain, and it is supposed to produce hope. There, of course, is a fine line between complaining and lamenting, but too often we dismiss the baby with the bathwater. Dan Allender says that the one who laments often looks like a grumbler or complainer, but that biblical lament is nothing of the sort. Instead, lament contains in itself the possibility of extraordinary hope, restored desire, and a changed heart. Lament is, at its core, a search for God. It is not a search for answers. It is not an invitation to fix the ailment. Rather, lament enters the agony with the recognition that it might not go away for days, months, even years. And yet, the lament carries with it the hope that God will eventually show. Dan Allender puts it this way, lament is a search, a declaration of desire that will neither rest with a pious refusal to ache, nor an arrogant self-reliance that is a hardened refusal to search. What if we were a community, rather than having to hold it together, we were a community that moved. As we look to Christ, we set aside our weights and hindrances and run with endurance the race set before us. What if part of that is rejoicing with those who rejoice? Rejoicing is a movement. It is paying attention to the gifts that God has given us and responding with thankfulness to Him. Lamenting is responding to the places where we experience death, pain, rejection, disappointment, and move to God with it and say, God, if we're going to be in a relationship, you need to know how hard this is for me. And the foundation of any of that would be this. As we look again at Joshua 1. As God speaks to Joshua, He says, as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will never leave you nor forsake you. The reason, the foundation upon which we have to sit and rejoice with those who rejoice and to mourn with those who mourn is the fact that God says that He will never leave us nor forsake us. That's the gift that we offer to each other in community. Because Christ tabernacles and dwells in me, I have the opportunity to be God's representative to others in community. Because God tabernacles in us and because God will never leave us or forsake us, we are able to be part of the manifestation of His promises to never leave or forsake. We're not the ones that necessarily have to bring the comfort when God says, blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. But what if God chooses to use us as part of His comfort? What if God chooses to use us as part of the way that others rejoice? The foundation upon which we live and walk in community with others is the fact that God will never leave us nor forsake us. And so because of that, we call each other to perseverance. We call each other to continue to move towards Christ, who for the joy set before Him endured the cross. We continue to run because it's Christ who dwells in us. One last thing. As God speaks to Joshua, He continues, be strong and courageous because you will lead these people to inherit the land. Be strong and very courageous. And then a third time, He says, have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. In community, one of the things that we're able to offer to each other is accountability. As we walk this journey, we're able to call each other to a different form of living. I think a lot of times accountability is presented as this idea of, you screwed up, here's the list of what you're supposed to be, you didn't do it, so here we go. We're going to go to the table and we're going to go out to the woodshed and take care of business. And maybe that's part of it. But what we see God doing here is a little bit different. What God is saying to Joshua is, be strong and courageous. He says, be strong and courageous, not do strength and courage. You see, God is calling forth in Joshua what He has already put there. God is not saying, Joshua, come on, be strong, be courageous, put on something that you don't already have. See, there's language in the Bible where Paul would say, therefore, put on the whole armor of God. We're taking something and putting it on. God isn't saying, put on strength and courage. He's saying, be strong and courageous. Because I have already made you that way. Because I tabernacle in you, part of your nature is someone that is strong. Part of your nature is someone who's courageous. What if part of being an exilic community as we journey between Eden and eternity is reminding each other of who we truly are, reminding each other that we are strong because God dwells in us, because He's made us that way, reminding each other that we are courageous, and because of that, we continue to walk. It may be a limping walk, but we continue to walk. I heard a sermon a few months ago where the pastor was talking about caterpillars and butterflies. Okay, so what does that have to do with anything? What he said was this. He said, if you take a caterpillar, extract DNA, I don't know how you would do that, but if you're really smart and know how to do that, and you took it to a biologist and said, hey, I want you to just examine this and tell me what you find. The really smart biologist would examine and he would come back to you and say, you know, he'd push up his glasses and he would say, well, what we find here from this DNA sample that we took was that you have a butterfly. And he would talk about what makes it a butterfly. And what you might say to him is, well, that's interesting because I gave you a DNA sample of a caterpillar. That's really interesting. And so what this pastor was saying in this sermon is what we're speaking about here. I think a lot of times in this life, we act as though we're caterpillars. Because we live in a broken and fallen world, we still are very sinful people. We live with a lot of depravity because we are sinners. And a lot of times we look so much like broken, sinful, needy people. But because Christ tabernacles in us, the reality is who we really are is more like a butterfly. Because of Christ tabernacling in us, we have the righteousness of Christ dwelling in us. That's the kind of accountability I want. Matt, you're acting like a butterfly. When what you really are is a butterfly. You're acting like a sinful, broken man. When what you really are is a man who has great dignity because you're made in God's image and because Christ is in you. Be that man. And so we invite each other to accountability. Just one last thought before we will be done. I, about 2.5 years ago, was asked to play music in a wedding and at the reception. And I was asked to do it with a friend who plays cello. Great friend of mine. He and I have played music together a lot. And so we kind of thought, okay, well, this will be really fun. It'll be really easy. We just kind of play a few you know, pop songs, we play some worship songs, whatever. So we meet with the husband and wife, and they say, well, here's the CD of music that we want you to play. We trust you, you're good musicians. See you at the wedding. So I get the CD, I get into my car and put it in. First track is Dvorak's Spring, which, if you're not familiar, that is a full symphonic piece of music that was not written for an acoustic guitar and a cello. I've never felt musically more like a rinky-dink redneck. Okay, we're going to play Dvorak on guitar. And then going to the next piece. It's a full symphonic Bach piece. And then there's a couple other pieces that are kind of, you know, your normal worship songs. And then there's a piece that is a full orchestra part song. And so I called my friend and was just like, how in the world are we going to do this? And actually, it was one of probably the coolest things I've been part of musically, is figuring out how we're going to play a full symphony piece just on two instruments. But what I would say is, as cool as it was and as actually really good as I thought, as we were able to make it sound, it was lacking something. It was lacking a whole lot. It was lacking a full string section of violins and violas and cellos and basses. It was lacking the full brass section of trombones and trumpets and tubas. It was lacking percussion. And lately I've just been thinking about the idea of tension in music. If you go to a symphony, there is a lot of built-up tension that happens if you pay attention enough. Because there are so many different parts and so many different moving pieces, there are times where there's a lot of butting of heads. Now, I was talking to my brother who is getting his doctorate in music right now and some other musician friends of mine, and they said, music without tension is really boring. And the sign of a good composer is one who builds tension and then resolves tension. And a lot of times the way that tension is built and that tension is resolved is unexpected and is surprising. That's what makes a good composer. And so as we think about engaging in community and rejoicing with those who rejoice and mourning with those who mourn, as we call each other to perseverance, to continue walking, as we call to account one another and remind each other, this is who you really are. There will be tension, period. As we are faithful to be who God has created us to be, like a symphony that is well played, there will be great tension because God is a great symphony writer. What if part of what God wants to do in bringing out the melody of the gospel is to have tension amongst community? My friends were saying that ultimately the tension that is felt in music and the movement and the swelling of orchestra is the foundation and the backdrop in which the melody pops. The melody soars over the tension. What if us living in community is the orchestra that builds and lives in tension and harmony so that the melody of the gospel soars? And so as we continue in worship this morning, what better place to come? We'll sing a song and then we'll take the Lord's Supper. What better place to come to remember this side of Eden, this side of eternity, we experience death and we see it as we see Christ's body and blood, who is bruised for our transgressions and died the death that we deserved so that we could partake in Him and have life. And as we take it, we are reminded that God is tabernacling in us, that we are His. And out of that, we continue to walk in strength and courage. And we continue to move in towards relationship with one another. Because it is in context of community that God's melody, that God's character is seen and revealed. So let me pray, and we will continue on. God, even this morning, I feel the pull of life and death and the confusingness that that is. God, I need others in my life that will mourn with me, that will rejoice with me, that will remind me of Your presence in my life. I need those that You have given to me, and I need to be who You've created me to be to those that You've given me to. So God, as we continue, as we taste and see that You are good, would You continue to invite us to that? And so I'd even just ask us to just take a minute to silently reflect and respond to the Spirit, to the things that God may be sharing with us this morning.